Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the mental health of students. The pandemic has made things worse for many.
I kind of like turned off. My personality turned off. And what was left was just anxiety and like depression.
What some healthcare professionals are seeing. Nurses have been on the front lines of the pandemic, and it's taken a toll on many of them. Some have even left the profession. We'll hear about how those entering the nursing field are being trained to handle the pressures of the job. A lot is at stake when it comes to energy legislation in the state, including communities who rely heavily on nuclear plants for jobs and tax dollars, plants that are targeted to shut down. And you might remember a program called Wrestling at the Chase. A rock musician was a fan. Now he's a wrestling promoter, trying to bring back that entertainment to St. Louis. Those stories and more on this week's Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and ahead this hour, nurse burnout. It's a real thing, and it was a problem before the pandemic, which has now, of course, made things worse. We'll hear about that. Also, major energy legislation remains stalled at the State House. What is at stake for some communities? We'll take a closer look. And a lot of schools are using a saliva-based coronavirus test developed by the University of Illinois. Those stories and more ahead this hour on Statewide. Well, many areas of the state have seen an uptick in COVID vaccinations in recent weeks, but health officials would like to see more of the shots being given. Eric Stock talked with several people in McLean County who waited months to get the vaccine.
Darion Coe of Bloomington was about to start classes at Heartland Community College. Cox says she doesn't like needles, but when it came to the COVID-19 vaccine, she didn't really have a say.
I was forced to get the shot by my grandmother.
Darion's dad, Derek Coe, took his daughter to a vaccination clinic at their church, Center for Hope Ministries in Bloomington, to get the COVID vaccine. Derek Coe says he wanted to provide extra protection for his daughter as she went back to school.
I would surely hate to be a person that decided not to get vaccinated and then something bad happens. And you're like, man, maybe I could have prevented it.
The Coes are part of a small but growing number of McLean County residents who decided after months of hesitation to get the vaccine. Their reasons for waiting vary. Derek Coe says he had no desire to be first in line to vaccinate. He wanted to see how others responded to the vaccine before he put it in his arm.
Well, I'm not very quick type person that's very quick to just because everybody else is jumping up and doing something. I don't care about that. You know what I mean? So everybody wants to jump up and jump off a cliff, say it's good for your health. Well, I'll wait and see. I ask you after you hit the bottom.
Coe says he now believes the vaccine is safe, so he was ready to roll up his sleeve. It's people like Coe who are leaving clues for health officials who want to better understand who remains vaccine hesitant. The McLean County Health Department hosted a walk-in vaccination clinic at the county fair earlier this month. Jo Young of Bloomington had planned to take her 9-year-old son Isaac to the fair. She says free carnival rides for all vaccines were a nice sweetener, but she had planned to get the vaccine anyway. Young says she lost 2 grandparents to COVID-19. And Young says she waited so long to vaccinate because she had contracted the coronavirus. Nearly 20,000 McLean County residents have tested positive for the virus. Young says she still had hesitation.
There was a part of me that was, I don't like to put foreign things in my body, and I take my health seriously. And, you know, there was always that thought. But after seeing so many people get vaccinated, and there's so many incentives to be vaccinated.
Young is a social worker for Unit 5 schools. She says the district's quarantine rules are more relaxed for vaccinated staff who may be exposed to someone who has COVID-19. She says that was another incentive to get the vaccine. Others said it wasn't their choice to wait. Dawson Marshall will be a senior at Bloomington High School. Marshall says he wanted to get the vaccine for months, but he struggled to find time until he came upon the vaccine clinic at the fair.
It's hard to get time out of my day to do it. I work 2 part-time jobs, so it was just convenient. It was something I had time to do. I mean, I was at the fair and I saw it, so thought I might as well.
Marshall says he always wears a mask and wants to go into the medical field. He says it was scary for his family when his father got COVID. McLean County Health Department spokesperson Marianne Manco says many people have delayed getting vaccinated for various reasons. Some don't have time. Some waited until they got their child's school immunizations. But Manco says health department staff surveyed people at the county fair vaccine clinic and found the highly contagious Delta variant was a big driver.
The overwhelming majority of the people said, you know, the Delta variant was frightening them. They weren't really sure that they were going to get it. You know, some of them were just taking a wait and see look, and they realize now it's time to stop waiting.
The COVID scare is what brought Delisha Neal of Normal to a vaccination clinic. Neal says she fought the vaccine at first.
Seeing that a lot of people was getting ill and sick off of it, and then to protect others as well. My son ended up with it. And from there, I'm like, okay, well, maybe I need to rethink.
Neal's son, Avani Brown of Bloomington, says he felt chest pressure, lost his appetite, lost all energy when he contracted the coronavirus. Brown got the vaccine because he didn't want to run the risk he could go through all that again or spread the virus to someone else.
I'm athletic. I like to get up and enjoy my day. So lately, the virus, or the disease, I call it, It withhold you from a lot mentally, too. I feel like everybody should get it.
Delisha Neal says there's still a lot of hesitation, especially in the Black community, about the vaccine, even though COVID-19 has hit minority communities especially hard. Neal says public outreach has helped.
By us, them educating us and telling us that, you know what I'm saying, it's okay, you know what I'm saying, and we still have a lot that's still is not okay with taking a vaccine. So that's it's a preference, but I'm just saying I'd rather take the chance than not.
Health officials have also tried to reduce hesitancy by bringing the vaccine to communities that have been most resistant. Derek Cole Bloomington says it put him more at ease to get the vaccine at his church.
It definitely helped that it was in a familiar setting with friends and loved ones around. So to making sure that everything runs smoothly, it makes you feel a lot better that, you know, you can kind of laugh and smile with your loved ones around.
Coe says he got the COVID vaccine and a blessing at the same time. I'm Eric Stock.
The COVID-19 pandemic has been stressful on just about everyone, but healthcare workers might be impacted the most. Some are burnt out and ready to leave the profession. Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs tells us more.
Bridget Otto says she's dreading watching her hospital COVID unit fill up once again.
The last shift that I was there, we lost several people that were very young. And I mean, there were multiple times on our shift that we just bawled. Like we just gave each other a hug and cried.
Otto is a nurse in the medical intensive care unit at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She's been working directly with COVID patients for almost a year and a half. But Otto says with the vaccine now available, this newest wave is different and more difficult. Her patients are now younger, sicker, and almost always unvaccinated.
It's so much harder because now the grief we're seeing at the bedside, because we're allowing some visitors come, is regret.
Otto says she used to consider herself a lifer in the intensive care unit. COVID changed that. She's decided to go back to school this fall to pursue a degree as a family nurse practitioner.
Something to work towards that I won't be in a dedicated COVID ICU is just kind of like enough to keep me going right now.
Nurses like Otto have seen the COVID-19 pandemic up close. In hospitals, they spend a lot of time directly caring for really sick patients, and they've had to shoulder the grief of their patients' deaths when family members were not allowed at their bedsides. Lisa Caffery is the president of the Iowa Nurses Association. She says nurses are used to death, but not the numbers they've seen during this pandemic.
It'd be like walking into a mass casualty event every day, and that's kind of what it's like. That's a difficult thing to sustain over a long period of time.
Caffery says she's heard of many Iowa bedside nurses quitting or retiring early in the past year. That's pushed some of those remaining to work extra 12-hour shifts amid waves of sick patients.
Normally you only do that, you know, 3 days a week. Well, they're doing that 7 days a week in some situations, and they're just simply exhausted.
Nurses have been in short supply for years. Although applications to U.S. nursing programs are up during the pandemic, many hospitals struggle to keep the nurses they hire. One nationwide survey found nearly 1 in 4 new RNs leave their job within a year. Kylie Olson graduated from nursing school last summer and got her first job in a COVID unit in Pella, Iowa. She calls it baptism by fire.
It was one of those things where I felt like I wasn't necessarily the most qualified person to be able to take care of these patients who were really, really sick, but there was no one else there who could do it.
Olson says if she hadn't been transferred to the hospital's labor and delivery unit in February, she may have quit nursing. She says her group of friends from school have all felt the same way.
All 10 of us have said that we don't know if nursing is what we want to be doing for the rest of our lives.
Experts say the pandemic has just amplified longstanding issues in nursing. Jessica Rainbow is an assistant professor of nursing at the University of Arizona.
We, for so long, have really shied away from making legislation about staffing, for example, and really trying to address burnout.
Rainbow has been collecting stories from nurses during COVID. She wants to use them to push for more regulations like patient-to-nurse ratio requirements, something Iowa, like most states, doesn't have. Despite all the challenges, Rainbow says she's hopeful that increased awareness about burnout among nurses will lead to lasting change. I'm Natalie Krebs.
While many nurses are feeling that burnout, colleges are preparing new graduates to take their place and deal with the pressures of the job. Steph Whiteside tells us more.
Heather Hampson works at John A. Logan College in Southern Illinois, helping to train the next generation of nurses. I spoke with Hampson and her colleagues in the empty nursing lab, where teaching dummies lay in gurneys next to IV stands and crash carts. She says the pandemic brought a lot of attention to the profession, and that motivates students.
Most people look at this nurses and all healthcare providers as heroes through this pandemic. So I think that it encourages them and energizes them and motivates them to want to select this career path.
At the community college, instructors use labs and dummies to give students hands-on learning. The pandemic changed that, forcing students into online classes for a while. Hampson says that actually helped working students who worried about being quarantined and missing classes.
Many of them work in healthcare now, and so they would be they would have high exposures. So the fact that we were able to offer our classes in that setting so that they didn't miss any school was a great way to alleviate some of that stress and help them be successful.
Elena Novelli was studying to become a registered nurse. She was already working as an LPN, which became emotionally difficult during the pandemic.
It is very stressful, especially to watch residents die that have been in the facility for a long time and you've grown a strong connection with. It has been mentally exhausting and physically exhausting.
Throughout the pandemic, instructors did their best to continue essential hands-on training. Instructor Aaron McGuire says clinical work is essential for students.
Hopefully they were able to see what acute care is like in the moment, rather than maybe waiting until after they graduate before they see their first real patient.
Hampson says students also worked with local health departments.
And they gave over 30,000 immunizations in the last few weeks. I feel like that helped spin it so that they felt more in control and had this positive effect on our community.
McGuire says seeing what it's like to work as a nurse, including the stress of dealing with COVID, can help students choose the right path for them.
And I think when people saw the nurses who are out there on the front line and how tired they are and the struggles that they were having, you know, just doing their job in a pandemic, I think some of them at least took a hard look at it and really had to do some self-reflection and see, is this really what I want to do?
Even some practicing nurses are involved in that reflection. A survey done last December found nearly 1 in 4 nurses were planning to leave bedside care or the profession. Learning to handle the pressures of their job is part of the nursing education at Logan. Instructor Kristen Yersenovich says self-care is key.
It is very, very important that as a nurse, you cannot care for others if you cannot care for yourself. So putting yourself first at some times, having positive coping mechanisms and outlets is number one in priority to giving care to others.
Hampson encourages students to eat well, exercise, and find time for activities like yoga or reading. For Novelli, the pandemic resulted in new habits to shake off the stress of work and school.
So that took me a while to get a hang of, but actually at the beginning of the COVID, I picked up running and then I got into the gym a lot. Just having healthy habits and something that I could go and take my anger and frustration out at, the gym was really the place.
Despite the pandemic, staff say none of the students quit the program, and they've seen even more people consider enrolling. Andrew Biley, a student, says quitting wasn't an option for him.
Mentally, the biggest thing is it's scary. If you have the right amount of fear, it gives you the drive to do the best you can. Quitting's a very easy thing, but I think I used it to motivate me to just continue and finish, and it helped me become better than I ever would have been.
I'm Steph Whiteside.
A new law in Illinois could prove a boon to home bakers who want to sell their creations. It adds new rules for those in the cottage food industry, who previously could only sell their products primarily through farmers markets. The law expands options to include festivals, home sales, and shipping as a way to get items to the public. It also creates statewide food safety standards. Supporters say it comes at a crucial time, as many in the cottage food industry were hurt by the pandemic's cancellation of many farmers' markets. The law will take effect in January. The Illinois Stewardship Alliance estimates about 500 cottage food businesses are in Illinois, with most of them small farms and women-owned operations. Mendota High School has its own rural Illinois-style vaccine incentive. How about 100 pounds of beef? A local farmer who wished to remain anonymous reached out to the Mendota superintendent, Jeff Prusotter, asking if he could donate the quarter beef.
I'm not sure that there's a family out there that wouldn't appreciate being given $600 worth of high-quality beef.
Students who are already vaccinated or get a shot before mid-October are placed in a raffle, and the winner will be announced at a home football game at the Northern Illinois School. Prusotter says when they announced the sweepstakes on Facebook, some were less than thrilled, but he says he thinks the prize is less of an incentive than a thank you to those who get vaccinated to protect the community. As of this week, about 35% of Mendota High School students are vaccinated. Still on the way, we will check in with two communities that rely heavily on nuclear power plants for jobs and their tax base. Those plants are targeted to close unless the state comes up with more subsidies. That's ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and coming up, a tradition has returned to St. Louis, wrestling at the Chase. That story still to come. The Byron Nuclear Power Plant could close in just a few weeks, with a station in Dresden following soon after, and that is unless the Illinois General Assembly steps in. Peter Medlin has more from the communities trying to save those plants.
On the first days of the school year, students found tables in the halls of Byron schools stacked with envelopes and letters. The school district helped mail over 1,000 letters to Illinois political leaders. The letters urged them to pass an energy bill so Exelon's generating station will stay in town. Christine Lind is the president of their school board, and along with other local school and business leaders, she spent the last year championing nuclear power and pleading with politicians. Now, they're just days away from the planned closure with no deal.
I didn't think I could be more anxious. However, I proved myself wrong.
Lynn says 70% of the school district's income comes from tax revenue from the plant, and she expects it could take years for state aid to make up the funding they'd lose if the station shutters. The station in Dresden could shut down in November. The Coal City School District receives $16 million annually in property tax revenue thanks to the plant, which is a little bit less than half of their budget.
I've told everybody, you can't tax your way out of this, because you'd have to over double the taxes here.
That's Kent Bug, Coal City's superintendent. Bug is also the president of FairCom, which is a committee made up of taxing districts that are home to large energy-producing facilities, many of which are nuclear. He says it feels like their families are being held hostage in this political showdown.
I also can't cut $16 million overnight and still run the school district. So there would be a combination of a large tax increase and massive cuts in programming here for our kids.
He says it could also mean cuts to emergency services.
It's going to be devastating, not just to the functioning of our school district, but to the families we serve.
As in Byron, they've been sending letters, filing witness slips, and calling legislators. Now, advocates have their sights set on August 31st. The General Assembly reconvenes for a special session on redistricting, and they hope lawmakers bring up energy, too. Sue Rezin is a Republican state senator whose district contains 3 of the 6 nuclear power plants in Illinois, including Dresden. She's frustrated that none of the proposed energy bills have even been called for a vote.
Well, the governor's administration is holding up this bill in order to push the decarbonization component that will push the natural gas plants offline.
She's referring to the legislation that ties the nuclear power proposal with a plan to shut down coal-fired plants by 2035 and those fueled by natural gas by 2045. Rezin says lawmakers had a deal on nuclear back in May, but the fossil fuel portion of the bill has stalled negotiations.
The only way to decrease our carbon footprint is by keeping all of the nuclear power plants online, period. These plants provide 54% of our energy for the state of Illinois, and it's carbon-free.
The Byron and Dresden plants alone provide 30% of the state's carbon-free energy. Bug says even though his district would be devastated, it's bigger than just Coal City or just Byron. It's the whole region.
The Dresden station is the economic engine that runs our communities.
Economic impact reports from Northern Illinois University's Center for Governmental Studies show the stations play a massive role in the region's economy beyond the thousands of jobs they provide. The study concludes that every 100 jobs at the Dresden station support over 100 jobs in other industries like construction, restaurants, and real estate. And every $1 million in output from the Byron station supports another nearly $600,000 in the output of other businesses. So if the plants shutter for good, their communities are concerned that the ripple effects, economic, environmental, and social, will extend far beyond the immediate jobs lost when they close. I'm Peter Medlin.
And negotiations continue on that energy package that could put Illinois on track to 100% clean energy in the next few decades. The Illinois Department of Transportation is preparing for not just today's challenges, but tomorrow's as well. Tim Shelley spoke with the IDOT Secretary, Omar Osman, about autonomous and electric vehicles.
When it comes to connected vehicle, autonomous vehicle, obviously there have been work going on relative to those to autonomous vehicle for the last decade and maybe even more. Just combine that with the technology as it is today, with the innovation, with the internet, that is going to be the wave of the future. We must be ready to meet that demand. I always like to talk about if we go 100% autonomous, what does that mean to even how we design our highways? When we talk about connected vehicles, when we, what goes where. That is going to be a revolutionary concept. What you see out there today is totally going to be, it's going to be different because you're designing to connect a vehicle to a road. Basically, you're asking that vehicle to speak to the road. So that roadway design itself has to be totally different. And then there's quite the regulation that must come from our federal highway partners, from U.S. DOT, because the nature of this must be, everybody must be working on autonomous vehicle from the same platform. We cannot afford to have 50 states with 50 different regulations. It's not going to work. All that fits into one place that must be handled at a national level. It cannot be an IDOT issue, or cannot be a one particular state issue.
And with electric, I guess, EVs, helping even people find EVs at charging stations as they're driving has been a priority recently. But you look at the goals of where we want to be with EVs even, by 2030, and it seems to me like we need a massive build out of electric charging infrastructure and everything else that goes along with that to meet that goal by that time?
Absolutely. By definition, you must have that infrastructure in place. The governor is calling for 750,000 EV vehicle minimum by 2030. It's going to be a mute issue if we don't provide that infrastructure that is needed for a recharging station across the state. Not a one-off here and a one-off there. It's not going to work that way. The good thing is, if you look at the federal infrastructure bill that is being talked about, the one that particularly went through the Senate and got approved by the Senate in D.C., there is a portion of it, I believe, about $7.5 billion worth just to tackle the infrastructure for EV, specifically the charging station. What I foresee is this, that along each and every fuel or pump station, you're gonna see several charging stations. It's good, and it's not competing with that with the fuel station. As a matter of fact, if you talk to the gas station association, so to speak, they love this concept, because from their perspective, if somebody showing up trying to charge their electric vehicle at a gas station, they have a captive audience, and that means there's more sales. There's always a tendency to buy something from a gas station while you're waiting on your car to be charged. So that demand must be met.
That's the IDOT Secretary Omar Osman talking about the future of electric and autonomous vehicles, and he spoke with Tim Shelley. An Aurora art celebration found its way back home after venturing out to other parts of the city last year due to the pandemic. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
This past Saturday was hot and sweaty, but most of the artists in the 11th annual Alley Art Festival played in their usual pre-pandemic spot. Water Street Mall, which is the pathway between Downer Street and Galena Boulevard in the city's downtown, is dubbed as the Alley. This is the area where most of the participants in the festival post up. Last year, the location was much less crowded, with only a couple of artists scraping chalk across the concrete. Marissa Amoni is the manager of Aurora Downtown. She says, although most of the artists are back in their usual place, there are still other things happening across the city.
Jen Evans is partnering this year. She is the director of Aurora Public Art. She has created an amazing live mural installation that she's doing all around town.
The murals embellish several buildings across downtown. The live installation, coined Bum the Lot, took place at 14 Middle Avenue. Spray paint cans lined up on the concrete waiting for their time to shine as large graffiti letters took shape on boards across the lot. Graffiti artist Sim started his creation that day. He says he's tattooed his lettering across the city of Chicago and other areas, but this was his first time legally drawing in the suburbs.
And just to add, we do graffiti art because we like drawing letters. We like blending colors. There's no political message. There's no animosity.
He says he creates for other artists and not specifically for the public. Christopher Lucero is a photographer and face painter. He set up shop in the Alley. He says although the pandemic is still around, he is comfortable with hanging out in the familiar space again.
So what I like to do is interview someone, and in that interview I find something that they want to discuss, and that person writes a short 500-word summary, and based off of what they write is the type of sketch I'll draw.
He is working on a face painting and photography project that focuses on Dia de los Muertos, in English, Day of the Dead, a Latin American celebration honoring deceased loved ones that originated in Mexico. David Carey is from Geneva. He says he loves to support the people of Aurora. He was captivated by Lucero's work.
Well, my wife really was drawn in by one of these pictures. And then I noticed that this looked like somebody else that dressed up for Halloween once, but this is done so much better. And I enjoyed it.
Lisbeth Rio stood at an art booth wearing her banner for Mexicana Universal Aurora. She's competing for the title of Mexicana Universal USA. She says art is therapeutic.
Actually, also a therapist at Mutual Ground.
Mutual Ground is a nonprofit that helps people deal with domestic violence, substance abuse, and other issues.
And so I kind of wanted to incorporate those skills and kind of bring it into the art festival. I do believe that art is a way of expressing our emotions and our feelings.
Those who stopped by her area got a chance to reflect on things they are grateful for during the pandemic. Some wrote notes on heart-shaped construction paper that Rios posted on a board.
I had a teenager write that they love their makeup skills. And then for the adults, one of the adults told me that they love their family or they love like their good vibes. I really love this one that says I love my capacity to listen, learn, and grow and change. So just little things about themselves, not only like the physical aspect, but also like the inside of them too.
The festival also included a belly dancing performance at Millennium Plaza and face painting for kids by Jen Ingram. The graffiti from Bomb the Lot will stay up throughout the year. As time goes on, it will be replaced with other murals, perhaps at the next Alley Art Festival. I'm Yvonne Booz.
Pro wrestling returned to St. Louis last weekend after a nearly four-decade absence, reminding many of a popular TV show that once made St. Louis the wrestling capital of the world. Just a note, this story was produced prior to the event, but we wanted to bring it to you. Wayne Pratt reporting the revival is thanks to a woman wrestling champion and the leader of an alternative rock band.
Billy Corgan is the frontman of the Smashing Pumpkins, a band that reminisces about growing up in the late 70s in the song 1979. Also during those formative years, a young Corgan would gather in front of the TV every week with his grandmother for professional wrestling.
So I was literally like a five-year-old boy watching wrestling with an 81-year-old, you know, a Belgian immigrant.
Those moments sparked a lifelong love affair that eventually prompted Corgan to purchase the National Wrestling Alliance. And the NWA will be bringing back lots of memories this weekend for St. Louis wrestling fans.
It's Wrestling at the Chase.
From 1959 to 1983, Wrestling at the Chase was a mainstay on television. Big-time performers like Dick the Bruiser, Gene Kaniski, and Ric Flair were among the many who made their way through the Central West End landmark. And Corgan says that setting made Wrestling at the Chase unique, especially for events that were considered lowbrow entertainment.
It added a touch of class to it that wrestling has rarely encountered in its 100-plus years of being a viable public business for entertainment. So the Chase is always looked at with a sort of a bit of panache.
Sunday night's event marks the 73rd anniversary of the organization, which he says, much like the Chase, has seen better days as a force in the wrestling world.
When I bought the company, it was considered of such little value that nobody, including the WWE, even wanted it because it was just considered kind of a quote-unquote worthless three letters.
Corgan wants the NWA to spark a return to the old days of professional wrestling when there was a more local focus as opposed to the global giants that dominate today like World Wrestling Entertainment. But he's not totally ignoring the industry's changes since the glory days of Wrestling at the Chase. Tomorrow's pay-per-view is an all-female card, and the point person for that event is six-time WWE Women's Champion Mickie James.
This is the way forward. You know, we constantly say glass ceilings and equality, but my hope is that there are no more glass ceilings and that we can look at a female main event and not bat an eye.
She has achieved big-time success with more established promotions, but was drawn to the NWA in part because of the challenge of helping it return to prominence. James says connecting to the history of the Chase is one way to reach that goal, and that makes her think about what this would have meant to Missouri wrestling legend Harley Race, who died 2 years ago this month.
I know he's going to be watching over all of the NWA that night because it is his, you know, legacy. Perhaps him in the sky was one of the things that kind of helped bring this into fruition for us. Who's to say?
Tracking the history forged by Race and other wrestling legends is a special project for author Ed Wheatley. His book, Wrestling at the Chase, is being released this fall. Even though it's been nearly 40 years since wrestling took place at the Chase, Wheatley says for many, the appeal of people bouncing off the ropes and slamming into turnbuckles in an upscale hotel ballroom has never gone away.
Those four words, wrestling at the Chase,
immediately stimulates so many memories for everyone. Anyone over 40, I have to spend basically the next 5 minutes, 10 minutes listening to stories of excitement and fond, passionate memories.
And if all goes well, new generations could be making their own St. Louis wrestling memories. The NWA is interested in making the Chase a regular stop on its schedule. I'm Wayne Pratt, St. Louis Public Radio.
There is more ahead on Statewide. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Just ahead, we'll find out more about the saliva-based COVID test developed at the University of Illinois and now being used by many school districts. That story is coming up. But first, a mental health crisis existed before the pandemic. The last year and a half only exacerbated the problem for many young people. Wait times to see therapists grew, and visits to the emergency room for psychiatric reasons also increased. With students back in school, healthcare professionals are preparing for what's next. Susie Ahn reports.
Causey Stanton Thomas is an outgoing teen with a big smile and easy laugh. During the school year, they were busy with advanced courses at their Chicago school, a couple of jobs, and extracurricular activities. But because most of it was remote and they had limited options to see friends, Causey says the isolation really took hold. Causey uses the pronoun they.
It was a lot of sobbing, but sobbing to myself because I didn't want my family to hear. I kind of like turned off. My personality turned off. And what was left was just anxiety and like depression.
Causey says they're fortunate that they had a therapist before the pandemic, but they know many people didn't have that. Causey is part of a teen health council through a youth organization called Mikvah Challenge. They focus on teen mental health, especially during the pandemic. Mental health needs among teenagers were on the rise even before COVID-19. The past year and a half of health uncertainty, isolation, and other stressors only worsened the problem. But it also brought more attention to a long-standing crisis. As students head back to another school year during a pandemic, educators and healthcare workers are hoping an infusion of federal COVID relief dollars will help bring meaningful change.
We've seen an increase in the number of emergency room visits from, again, kids of all ages, but also from teenagers. And a lot of those have been around suicidal ideation.
Colleen Cicchetti runs the Center for Childhood Resilience at Lurie Children's Hospital. The hospital has seen about a 20% increase in emergency department visits for psychiatric reasons over the past year and a half. Calls for therapists have quintupled. Cicchetti says educators and parents have been looking for resources.
We put up one course specifically on psychological first aid, which is really thinking about how do you support kids who are experiencing distress. So we've just seen an incredible outpouring of adults asking for help with this issue.
As schools open up this month, teachers and staff are getting trained up on identifying levels of stress and how to address them. The Illinois State Board of Education has urged districts to use the millions of federal dollars for student social-emotional needs. Cicchetti says schools should use those funds with caution.
But it actually doesn't help us if they disappear at the end of a year when the grant goes away. So we've got to build sustainable approaches, not just one-and-done service delivery. So I hope, you know, that's where policymakers need to be thinking not just about the immediate, but the building that long-term structure.
A recent survey by RAND Corporation, a research group, finds 7 out of 10 schools will provide mental health programming this year. 5 out of 10 had already been doing so before the pandemic. Some schools are using the federal money to hire more mental health professionals and offer more training to staff. In Riverside Brookfield High School in the western suburbs, they're using a new program called Satchel to assess all students' social-emotional needs as they come back. Assistant Principal Beth Augustine says there were plenty of nerves on the first day, but overwhelmingly kids and teachers were happy despite the unique challenges of this year.
We're starting from scratch. You know, teachers are seeing two classes of kids that they haven't seen, and again, juniors that we really only had a little over a year with.
Teachers last year weren't able to build the relationships they normally do with students. especially with many of them keeping their cameras off during remote learning.
That's why I think that this quick screener will just sort of give us some baseline data.
All students will be screened, and some may receive further evaluation to see what help they might need. Augustine says school isn't a solution to mental health problems, but it can help students get connected to supports.
If we can get them in the building, at least if they're in student services, or we can find them a place where they can work quietly and work through their anxiety.
While some kids will be relieved to be back in the building, it might mean more anxiety for others. Students like Rocio Almazan says she's glad more attention is paid to student mental health, but thinks it's sad that it took a global pandemic for her school district to take note. Rocio struggled during remote learning and said she felt isolated and hopeless at times. She heard all last year how Chicago Public Schools wanted to bring kids back for in-person learning for students' well-being. She's not sure if she can believe that yet.
So sending us back is like, okay, these students have no excuse to not do homework, not go to class, be distracted. It's almost as if it's going to just be wiped away because we're going to go back and everything's going to be okay.
Rocio starts her junior year next week at Curie Metro High School, where she's only been in the building for part of her freshman year. She's grateful for how some of her teachers offered compassion during remote learning. But this year, she worries whether administrators will penalize kids who might not be ready to go back to, quote, normal.
Will there be the option of counseling? Or will me going to counseling affect my learning experience because it's going to be my fault that my grades are going to be bad?
The Chicago Teachers Union has been pushing CPS to spend federal money to expand its staff, including mental health professionals. The school district says it can't spend that money on new personnel because those funds will dry up in 2 years. But the district is using the money to expand mental health services through community partnerships to train staff on dealing with trauma, and the district was already due to add more nurses and social workers per the union contract. Tim Dorr is the director of teacher leadership at Northwestern University's School of Education and Social Policy. He says there's been a lot of focus on so-called learning loss during the pandemic. Schools may be tempted to seize on academics right away, but he says it's crucial to first build those relationships.
If I jump right into my science, right into my math, if I jump right into those things without stopping to recognize where are my kids, how are they feeling and experiencing the world right now, and where am I right now? If we don't do that first, we're never going to make progress with academics.
Dorr says with new cash on hand, schools have the opportunity to do creative things and make a real change for student mental health.
There needs to be a recognition that this is not business as usual. We are not going back to the fall of 2019 or even the fall of 2020 before all this happened.
He says no one is the same, and we have to be ready for that. Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
About a quarter of all K-12 school districts in Illinois have now signed up to use the University of Illinois' saliva-based coronavirus test. The hope is that regular testing will help identify infections before they turn into outbreaks. And to learn more, Christine Herman spoke with a U of I epidemiologist, Becky Smith.
Is there a one-size-fits-all, like this is what a K-12 school should be doing right now in order to be able to open safely, between mask-wearing, putting kids in pods, social distancing to the extent that that's possible, and some amount of regular, frequent testing? You're shaking your head no.
The joke is that if you would ask an epidemiologist a question, our answer is always going to be, it depends. So we never believe in one size fits all. The question is, what can you do effectively in your circumstances, and where are you? You know, if you're in Southern Illinois right now, we know there's a lot of infection going on right there. You might need a little bit more control than if you're in Central Illinois and cases are kind of low, although most of Illinois at this point is concerning. But if you're in Vermont, you might not need as much right now. But it's really a question of what you can make work for your circumstances. We're talking about layered mitigation. Obviously, you know, in a K-5 school, podding is going to be super easy because the kids don't interact much anyways. So it's a lot easier to introduce a pod in that circumstance than in a high school where the kids are mixing classes because they all need different mixes of classes. So maybe in a high school, you can't pod, but you're going to do something else So you really have to think about the practicality of all of these layered mitigations. It can't just be one thing.
And so what are the trade-offs for schools that are looking at the different testing options out there? And what's the benefit of doing the saliva-based PCR COVID test versus the Abbott Binax Now rapid antigen test? Because some schools say they're using one or the other or a combination of the two.
So the saliva-based PCR has two main advantages for K-12 schools that I see. One is that it's actually more sensitive before you become infectious, based on our data, so that it's very highly sensitive early in the infection. So you can find people hopefully before they've had a chance to spread. The other is that it's a lot easier to get kids to drool than to stick something up their nose once a week. And I know there was a lot of concern about the drooling, but kids manage it really well. So those are the advantages to the saliva. The advantage to the Binax Now is that it's fast. So I actually recommend that schools use both. It's not an either or, but the Binax Now is really useful if a kid comes to school with symptoms, because we know that those antigen tests are really sensitive at the time of infectiousness. So if somebody comes to school with symptoms, you can find out right now if they need to go home or not. Or if you're doing tests to stay, you can combine the PCR and the antigen test so that it's not all the PCR and then waiting 24 hours. You can actually use them both in combination for that test to stay program, which is a little bit easier on the school.
Let's talk about the test to stay component, which I understand allows kids to remain in in-person school even if they've been exposed to someone who tested positive, as long as they get a test on days 1, 3, 5, and 7 after that exposure and it comes back negative. Because I know since the start of the pandemic, people have wanted to know, if I'm exposed, can I just get a negative test and then go back to living my life? And the answer had always been no. But how is this different?
So the test to stay program, it's not one negative test. It's that you're testing every other day. So we know that it takes a couple of days to ramp up to infectiousness. And the idea of test to stay is that if we're testing you every other day, we're going to find you before you expose anybody else. And that's basically similar to something we were doing at the university. Last year, we called it Shield 3X, which is when we found a cluster of cases in a housing unit, in a house or a dorm, we would ask everybody in that housing unit to test every other day. Because the idea is that if you're testing that frequently, you don't even need to quarantine close contacts because you're going to find the case before it becomes infectious.
And the test to stay in that situation would either be the saliva test or the rapid antigen test?
Yeah, so we're recommending combinations of them. And I don't know what exactly combination they're really going with, but it would be generally probably a PCR and then an antigen and then a PCR.
So I've heard you speak on the 21st show about this, and I've heard it discussed elsewhere, that schools that reopened in person this past spring, in particular the ones that did certain mitigations like social distancing, pods, mask wearing, and I guess ventilation and other things, that they were able to operate safely. So if someone hears that and then they also hear like, oh, schools really, they should also be doing weekly testing, they might be a little confused. Like, wait, why would weekly testing be necessary? Because the schools say they're doing all these other things to try to make it safe for everyone to be here.
Yeah. And that is a good question. And sometimes we talk sometimes in infectious disease about the stochasticity of the system. And stochasticity is basically a fancy way of saying luck, that if you're lucky, you can get away without doing testing because nobody comes to school with a raging infection and takes their mask off at lunchtime and infects everybody sitting at the table with them. But relying on luck isn't what we like to do. So I would prefer to see some more mitigations so that we're not relying on just getting lucky as far as numbers. Also important to remember that the schools that did really well last spring, most of them were not at 100% capacity. So now we're back with 100% capacity, kids filled up in the classroom. It's going to be a lot harder. And last spring was pre-Delta. And we know that Delta is more infectious and it moves faster. And that is really concerning. And what worked under the previous, even with Alpha, where we were really concerned about the transmissibility, isn't going to work with Delta. You need more.
I know you've said you don't make predictions and you don't want to make a forecast, but do you think schools will be able to stay open?
I hope so. I think the schools that are instituting the masks and the testing and the vaccinations among staff, encouraging vaccinations among staff and doing the ventilation, I think they will probably have a better chance at staying open than the schools that are choosing not to.
That's U of I epidemiologist Becky Smith, and she spoke with Christine Herman. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. We're glad you could join us. We'll be back next time and have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this show or past shows, you can find them at nprillinois.org and through the NPR One app. You can also email us. The address is at the website. And like us on Facebook. Keep up with the show. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.